a similar bill is being considered that was sponsored by a total of 7 police-affiliated lawmakers. The bill's 2 primary sponsors, Representatives Charles Miller and Alan McNeil, respectively, served as Deputy Chief of the Brunswick County Sheriff's Office and Chief Deputy of Randolph County Sheriff's Office. Police culture is deeply embedded in our state legislatures, Gibson said, observing that many legislators have conflicts of interest when it comes to holding the police accountable. These bills are also heavily influenced by police organizations like Fraternal Order of Police and the Sheriff's Association, whose state chapters have lobbied for several different anti-riot bills throughout the U.S. since June. Consider Florida's HB 1, which became law in April. The comprehensive measure, which makes aggravated rioting a felony, denies bail to those charged of a misdemeanor during a protest and grants civil legal immunity to motorists who drive through demonstrators blocking a road. Was supported by the Florida Sheriff's Association, the Florida Police Chiefs Association, and Florida Smart Justice Alliance, a broad coalition of organizations focused on the state's criminal justice and correction system. Barney T. Bishop III, the CEO of Florida Smart Justice Alliance, explained his organization's stance in an interview with reporters, disputing the notion the HB 1 would embolden those on the far right to retaliate against social justice protesters. "It's not about emboldening anybody," he said. "Florida is as opposed to the Proud Boys and the far right groups as we are to the far right groups," unquote. His explanation of the bill's aims, however, suggests otherwise. Protesters today feel that they can go anywhere they want, do anything they want, beat some cars, cuss and try to incite violence from police by screaming in their face, Bishop added. "There are people that will incite violence. Most of the time, it will be the people in the protest themselves or the people behind the protest, like George Soros and Antifa and BLM. There is little evidence that last year's wave of social justice demonstrations after the Floyd murder was plagued by violence, according to a report last September by the Armed Conflict Location and Event Data Project, ACLED. About 95% of all demonstrations from last May to last August were peaceful. By comparison, the report notes that authorities have used force, such as firing less lethal weapons like tear gas, rubber bullets, and pepper spray, or beating demonstrators with batons in over 54% of the demonstrations in which they have engaged. Nora Benavides, director of PEN America's U.S. Free Expression Programs, affirmed ACLED's findings, telling reporters that the Republican-backed anti-riot bills are trying to solve a problem that doesn't exist. "Legislators are predicting their bills on a circumstance that characterizes protests as somehow inherently criminal. As in the Florida case, a newly enacted anti-riot bill in Iowa, SF-342, was backed by various police-affiliated organizations, including the Iowa Peace Officers Association, the Iowa State Police Association, The Iowa Fraternal Order of Police, the Iowa State Patrol Supervisors Association, and the Iowa State Sheriffs and Deputies Association, according to state lobbying records. Interestingly, the Iowa Peace Officers Association and the Iowa State Sheriff and Deputy Association were initially undecided on the bill after it was introduced in February. At the time, the bill simply sought to prevent police officers from being discharged, disciplined, or threatened with discharge if their names appeared on the Brady list, which tracks officers who might lack credibility in certain legal cases involving the police. Since then, the bill has morphed into full-fledged anti-riot legislation, which won the support of the two law enforcement associations. Adam Mason, State Policy Organizing Director for the Iowa Citizens for Community Improvement Action Fund, told reporters that the Iowa bill reflects the overrepresentation of police interest in the state legislature. "We absolutely believe in having a citizen legislature," Mason said, "but that also means we need to have a diversity of opinions. That would mean having legislators from all walks of life. It seems these legislators feel like they don't have to listen to community members because they are coming from concerted backgrounds in law enforcement." Bishop disagreed. "There is no more conflict of interest than a doctor selected to the legislature proposing medical legislation," he told reporters. A major reason why anti-riot bills are controversial are their provisions, which specifically grant civil and criminal immunity to drivers attempting to flee riots, especially given the violent counterattacks social justice protesters have seen in recent years. In 2017, during the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, an alleged white supremacist rammed his car into a throng of counter-protesters, killing a woman named Heather Heyer and injuring 19 others. The driver was later convicted of first-degree murder. More recently, in February of this year, an admitted Klansman drove his truck into a group of peaceful protesters near Richmond, Virginia, though nobody was seriously injured. Last year, NPR reported that there had been at least 50 vehicle ramming incidents since protests against police violence erupted nationwide in late May, a marked increase from prior years. Gibson told reporters that the uptick in vehicle-related violence against protesters is precisely what makes the recent surge in anti-riot bills so concerning. "You can't be a politician and not be aware that there is an undercurrent of informal vigilant justice," he explained. "Where the police are emboldening white supremacists to take things into their own hands. Most of the driver immunity provisions are predicated on two conditions: that the driver was fleeing a riot in order to protect themselves, and that they exercise due care in the course of colliding with demonstrators. But the reality in court might not be so straightforward." Sergeant Fred Lepley, senior director of the Iowa State Police Association, which supported SF-342, told reporters that incidents in which protesters threaten drivers are often difficult to comprehend without proper context. Lepley said that provisions are designed to assist citizens that are attempting to remove themselves from a dangerous situation but find that protesters are purposely forcing their hand by standing in front of the vehicle, refusing to let them leave and possibly attempting to get at the driver to do harm. In many of these cases, the driver is driving very slow and the protesters intentionally get in front of the vehicle, placing themselves in harm's way. Oklahoma Representative Justin Humphrey, a Republican who sponsored HB 1674, which also contains a driver immunity provision, echoed Lepley, saying by email that this bill is about protecting the public and that it enables a person to protect their family and themselves from criminals who demonstrate intent to commit harm, unquote. Reporters could not find evidence that recent demonstrators have deliberately impeded traffic in an effort to provoke or harm drivers. Other U.S. states where police organizations have actively supported anti-riot bills include Tennessee, Texas, Washington, Ohio, Missouri, Kentucky, Indiana, Idaho, Connecticut, Arkansas, and Arizona. Though most of these bills have surfaced within the last couple of years, Gibson told reporters that the Republican sense of urgency for their implementation has no logical or historical basis. Rioting was already a dangerous illegal type of behavior, he said, but people still did it. These politicians are deluging themselves if they think that making rioting extra illegal is going to change anything. They are trying to throw peaceful protesters in jail because that is more of a thorn in their side than the riots are.
Ibrahim Raisi is now officially the 8th president of the Islamic Republic of Iran after his mandate was endorsed by leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, at a ceremony in Tehran. Ayatollah Khamenei's decree endorsed the presidential mandate of Raisi. The text was read out at the event by head of the leader's office. The ceremony took place at Imam Khomeini Hosseiniyeh in Tehran in full compliance with COVID safety protocols and was attended by the country's senior state and military officials. Raisi said, through their participation in the election, the Iranian people sent a message that they are demanding change, justice, as well as a fight against corruption, poverty, and discrimination. For his part, Ayatollah Khamenei called for a swift formation of the administration and said the country's conditions do not warrant a delay in the process. Raisi is the 8th president of the Islamic Republic of Iran. He won almost 62% of the votes in the June 18th presidential election and will succeed President Hassan Rouhani, who served 2 4-year terms in office. Raisi will take an oath of office in an inauguration ceremony at the Iranian parliament, or Majlis, on Thursday. But his new government is set to face a series of challenges. First and foremost, Iran's economy needs urgent action and medium-term planning to grow. Cruel and illegal U.S. sanctions and the COVID-19 pandemic have severely hampered Iran's economic growth. Iran is also dealing with an unprecedented drought, which has negatively affected its energy production and its agriculture sector in certain parts of the country.
So Iran has survived the American sanctions. I think they can continue as long as they use imaginative ways of implementing the exchange of goods and services by different currencies or barter.
Raisi has pledged to prioritize Iran's domestic needs and combat poverty, unemployment, inflation, and corruption. But in order to achieve that end, a certain give and take on regional issues is necessary, and Iran can prosper by playing an even greater stability role commensurate with the country's pivotal position.
Well, in my view, I think President Raisi won't necessarily remove the sanctions, but what he will do is increase Iran's ability to circumvent them. It's possible, for example, to use other currencies than the United States dollar to pay for trading back and forth.
Raisi has vowed not to repeat his predecessor's mistake of putting nearly all the bets on the nuclear deal and the resolution of foreign-imposed sanctions. He said he will decouple his agenda from the nuclear deal, known as the JCPOA, Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Raisi has called on the U.S. to live up to its nuclear deal obligations.
I think President Raisi is talking more about countries such as Iraq and Syria and Libya and Lebanon and neighboring countries such as Afghanistan and Pakistan. I think that relying on Saudi Arabia and Israel and the Gulf states is a non-starter.
Raisi has said time and again that his government will solidify the relationship between Iran and regional countries. He's described strong ties with Iran's neighbors as important for the economy.
A somber mood prevails in Japan as the nation marks the 76th anniversary of the United States nuclear attack on the city of Hiroshima. The horrific atomic bombing was carried out during the final stages of World War II in 1945. On August 6 that year, an estimated 140,000 people were incinerated immediately under a mushroom cloud or died in the following months. Meanwhile, Japan is preparing to honor the victims of America's second nuclear strike. The bombing of the city of Nagasaki a few days later left tens of thousands of others dead. Many decades have passed since the world experienced the horrors and pain of nuclear attacks. The world doesn't truly seem to have learned a lesson from the catastrophes. Atomic weapons still pose an existential threat to humankind. There have been international calls for the total annihilation of nuclear arms worldwide. But atomic arsenals are not being dismantled or even reduced in number. They are instead being expanded and upgraded regardless of the incredible dangers and costs. The United States, which is the only country to have used nukes against another nation, is ironically leading the race to develop new nuclear weapons and modernize existing ones. The U.S. has openly accelerated the costly modernization of the American arsenal. Figures show that in recent years, America has spent heavily on its nuclear weapons program, almost as much as all other spenders like China, Britain, and Russia combined. The costs of such modernization programs run into the tens of billions of dollars each year.
I know in the United States there are very strong lobby groups that are representing the weapons industry, groups that represent companies like Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, Honeywell. These are some of the large producers of nuclear weapons. And they lobby Congress to pass more money. And what we saw is it really doesn't matter who is in the White House.
United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres called on governments to make the goal of a nuclear weapons-free world a reality. The UN chief warned that the push by nuclear weapons states to modernize their atomic arsenals has sparked a new arms race.
The U.S. now says that it needs to modernize these nuclear weapons because it's facing the adversary of China. But this is ridiculous because China has very few nuclear weapons and a much smaller military than the United States in all aspects, and it's not a time to be fueling a new race for nuclear weapons. It's a time to be recognizing that the world needs to conserve its resources to put into things like healthcare, getting rid of COVID, those kind of things, the climate issue.
The situation has undermined global security, but nuclear armed states are reluctant to even discuss disarmament. It is ironic that most of the big spenders on atomic arms are permanent members of the United Nations Security Council. They are definitely not making the world a safer place by spending more and more on such weapons of mass destruction. The United States and Russia have over 90% of all nukes worldwide, with over 14,000 warheads. America has the biggest number of deployed warheads, with hundreds of them ready to be used. India, Pakistan, and North Korea also possess nuclear weapons, but have not joined the non-proliferation treaty. Meanwhile, Israel, which developed nuclear weapons in the 1960s with Western assistance, is the only possessor of nukes in West Asia. Israel and its supporters have blocked all efforts meant to create a nuclear weapons-free zone in the region. Possessors of these weapons have defied international calls to disarm. Observers believe they are responsible for the persistent threat of nuclear war.
On Thursday, an Israeli-managed oil tanker came under attack off the coast of Oman. The Liberian-flagged and Japanese-owned vessel, dubbed Mercer Street, was reportedly on its way from Dar es Salaam, Tanzania, to Fujairah in the United Arab Emirates when it was targeted. In a statement on Friday, Zodiac Maritime, the Israeli-owned firm managing the oil tanker, said that two crewmen, a Briton and a Romanian, had been killed in the assault. In recent months, several other Israeli-managed ships have come under attack on various maritime routes across the world. Israel was quick to accuse Iran of carrying out the attack, pushing for a United Nations action against Tehran. This is while Iran has denied any involvement in the attack. But that's ironic, as the regime has had more UN resolutions imposed against it than the rest of the world combined.
You know, hypocrisy in the international scene is nothing new, and we are all familiar with that. That's one point of view. Make some alliance against Iran to make it politicize actually the situation and take it to the Security Council of the United Nations to put more pressure on Iran to force the next administration to go to the negotiation table over the nuclear issue, and they hope for further talks on regional issues or missile programs, such things, but it doesn't seem to work like that, actually.
The United States and the United Kingdom have joined Israel in hurling the accusation at Iran without providing any corroborative evidence. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken claimed that Washington is confident that Iran conducted the attack on the empty Mercer Street and vowed, quote, an appropriate response. Blinken has also stated that there will be a collective response against Iran. British Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab also said UK assessments had concluded that it was highly likely that Iran used one or more drones to carry out the deadly attack.
Forcing their ally in the region, which is actually the regime created, actually manufactured by them in the many decades ago. So it is natural that they would support that, and they want to put pressure on Iran. We know that we are in a time of transition of power in Iran. President Raisi is going to actually take the office in upcoming days. And this time is a time that they think that there can be some, let's say, uncertainty in the government and power in Iran. So they're trying to put pressure on the next administration, actually.
The spokesman for Iran's foreign ministry, however, has warned against any possible act of adventurism against country's interests, pledging an immediate, powerful, and serious response to any such move. a source close to Iran's Supreme National Security Council, said that threats issued by Western officials and Israel are considered more of a propaganda gesture. The source, however, vowed any move against Iran's interests and national security will be met with Tehran's, quote, crushing and firm response, and Washington and London will be directly responsible for the consequences. There are also unconfirmed reports that Israel has gotten the green light from the U.S. to go ahead with an attack that may involve targeting an Iranian port or vessel.
It is time of transition of power in Iran, but the Westerners think that this time of transition is affecting the military power and will of Iran. But the military and the armed forces are not under the president in Iran. And so that by the change of the administration, the policies or the actually vigilance of the armed forces would change.
If the report is true, it goes to show that London and Washington have given Israel carte blanche to commit crimes with impunity. But as Iranian officials have stressed, any possible aggression won't go unanswered.
More than 15 million American renters are at risk of eviction without backup as a ban on residential evictions expired on Saturday at midnight. Early Sunday, some Democratic lawmakers rallied outside the Capitol to call for the ban's reinstatement. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention ordered the moratorium to fight the spread of the COVID-19 and prevent homelessness during the pandemic. It came into effect in September 2020 and has been extended multiple times. The U.S. Congress had approved around $47 billion in rental relief to states during the pandemic, but the money has been slow to make it into the hands of those in need. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said only $3 billion out of the total allocated fund has been distributed to renters. Pelosi and other top Democrats have urged the administration of Joe Biden to extend the moratorium through October the 18th. The U.S. President Joe Biden is under fire by his own party members. The Democrats criticized Biden's inaction as the deadline neared, some furious that he called on Congress to provide a last-minute solution to protect renters. Biden had asked Congress to extend the deadline on Thursday amid the surging Delta variant, but Congress failed to act after Republican House members blocked a Democratic-led bid. The House has already left for a six-week summer recess, and it remains unclear whether the administration could extend the moratorium using executive powers.
It's a partisan issue. There's absolutely no difficulty with the United States providing the money to their own citizens to enable them to pay their rental commitments. And it's something I argued back in March of 2020, where it's absolutely necessary because if you're going to fight the virus, you have to enable people to stay at home. If they stay at home, they can't earn an income, so they must be given a cash flow to cover their outgoings, so you don't get people being made homeless courtesy of fighting a pandemic.
Pressure is mounting on U.S. lawmakers to extend a moratorium that barred landlords from evicting certain tenants who could not pay rent during the pandemic. This put millions of Americans at risk of being homeless amid the coronavirus pandemic. Meanwhile, top U.S. infectious disease expert Anthony Fauci has warned that the coronavirus situation in the United States is set to get worse as the country grapples with a surge in the Delta variant of the COVID-19. The U.S. is currently the worst-hit nation by the pandemic. Homeless Americans could face other challenges as well. For instance, Los Angeles has approved a new law that makes it illegal for unhoused people to be in almost all places across the city. If you become homeless in LA, that's the fair fate that awaits you. That's why the latest city count shows LA has over 66,000 homeless people.
And it shows the extent to which the American political system uses its own people as a bargaining chip or a shuttlecock in this battle between the two ruling parties. So it's utterly unnecessary and it'll be very damaging. And again, it's a sign of just how divided America is these days that this is being allowed to happen.
The expiration of the U.S. eviction ban could send millions of people out on the streets. Then they're faced with the threat of the coronavirus and hunger. Currently, around 40 million low-income Americans rely on the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program to stay out of hunger. It seems the U.S. politicians are more interested in spending money on wars and U.S. military bases and adventures around the world instead of their own people.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight.
The United States has the highest infant and maternal mortality rates, the lowest life expectancy at age 60, and the most glaring inequities, according to a new report released recently by the Commonwealth Fund. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jake Johnson Ryder. This article is published under the heading U.S. healthcare system ranks dead last among rich nations. Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. The United States has the highest infant and maternal mortality rates, the lowest life expectancy at age 60, and the most glaring inequities, according to a new report released recently by the Commonwealth Fund. Using a range of criteria to evaluate the healthcare systems of 11 countries, the Commonwealth Fund's latest analysis shows that the U.S. once again ranks last on access to care, administrative efficiency, equity, and healthcare outcomes. The lone bright spot for the for-profit U.S. healthcare system, according to the new report, is in a category dubbed care process, which includes measures of preventive care, safe care, coordinated care, and engagement and patient preferences. There is no question, our cruel for-profit healthcare system is broken, said Representative Pramila Jayapal, chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus and lead House sponsor of the Medical Care for All Act of 2021, in response to the report. Jayapal added, "It's time to fix it. It's time to guarantee health care as a human right. It's time for Medicare for All." In In 2019, the U.S. spent 16.8% of its GDP on healthcare, 5.5 percentage points more than the next country on the list. By contrast, Norway, which has the top-performing system according to the Commonwealth Fund's metrics, spent just 10.5% of its GDP on healthcare that same year. Despite key high spending fueled by several factors, including exorbitant prices for prescription drugs and medical services, the United States ranked last in 9 of the Commonwealth Fund's 10 outcome measures, including preventable mortality, that is about 177 deaths per 100,000 population. Life expectancy at age 60, that is 23.1 years, and infant mortality, 5.7 deaths per 1,000 live birth. The United States maternal mortality rate, 17.4 deaths per 100,000 live birth, is more than 2 times higher than France's, that is 7.6 deaths per 100,000 live births. One potential cause of poor health care outcomes in the U.S., the report notes, are deep inequities in access to the expensive system, which is, in large part, dominated by major private insurance companies and for-profit hospital systems. According to the Commonwealth Fund, the United States consistently demonstrated the largest disparities between income groups when it came to obtaining healthcare services. Due to inability to afford the cost, low-income people in the U.S. were far more likely to report skipping treatments and doctor visits than low-income residents of other rich nations. The U.S. disparities are especially large when looking at financial barriers to accessing medical and dental care, medical bill burdens, difficulty obtaining after-hours care, and use of web portals to facilitate patient engagement, the report reads, adding, the U.S. healthcare system delivers too little of the care that's most needed, and often delivers it too late, especially for people with complex chronic illness, mental health problems, or substance use disorders, many of whom have faced a lifetime of inequitable access to care. The high U.S. death toll during the COVID-19 pandemic, the report continues, illustrates the difficulty of achieving good healthcare outcomes if the population is sicker and access to preventive and primary care is limited, particularly because of affordability barriers. The Commonwealth Fund spotlights 4 features of high-performing healthcare systems that allow them to deliver far superior care for less cost than the fragmented U.S. system. They provide for universal coverage and remove cost barriers. They invest in primary care systems to ensure that high-value services are equitably available in all communities to all people. They reduce administrative burdens that divert time, efforts, and spending from health improvement efforts, and they invest in social services, especially for children and working-age adults. In a series of tweets calling attention to the new analysis, Physicians for a National Health Program argued there are many issues plaguing the U.S. healthcare system, but single-payer Medicare for All would address some of most pressing problems by establishing no-cost access to care for all Americans, bolstering primary care, and drastically reducing administrative costs. Ultimately, the group wrote, lives are at a stake in the U.S.
protests in Cuba have rocked international headlines for several weeks now. It's said that they began on July 11th, 2021, and have spread all across the Caribbean island into several dozens of cities. Now, the United States has not only welcomed these protests, but encouraged them too. U.S. President Joe Biden not only kept former President Donald Trump's maximum pressure campaign on the Caribbean nation, but increased sanctions, saying that this is just the beginning. Several prominent lawmakers in Congress, specifically in the Republican Party, have advocated direct intervention in Cuba, even suggesting airstrikes. Now, Cuba has responded that the entire affair is orchestrated by the United States in order to interfere in Cuba's internal politics. And they point to decades of covert and overt assaults on Cuba. They point to the embargo, and they point to the United States' efforts to malign the Caribbean nation. Several other presidents in the region expressed their support. President Maduro of Venezuela, President Obrador of Mexico, both raised concern that the United States should not be using humanitarian endeavors as a shield or a pretext in order to interfere in Cuba's internal affairs. So what is happening in Cuba? In order to find out, I went to get the other side of the story that you don't hear in corporate and mainstream media. I sat down with the chargé d'affaires of the Cuban embassy and permanent mission to the United Nations in Vienna. We talked extensively about these protests, the embargo, and much more. I'm Richard Medhurst.
And this is The Communique.
Marlene Rodendo, the chargé d'affaires here at the Cuban embassy in Vienna. Thanks for taking the time to receive us. I want to talk about what's happening in Cuba. You know, there are a lot of questions that people have. What is happening in Cuba? What are these protests that are taking place there? What's the real size of these protests? Could you tell us more about what the situation actually is there?
First of all, I would like to thank you for inviting me to your program to do this interview, because I think this is very important, because there has been a very huge disinformation campaign against Cuba. The projection of the media on the situation in Cuba has been very far from reality, even here in Vienna and in other medias in Europe. And to answer your first question regarding the real size of the protest and what is going on in Cuba right now, I first of all have to talk about what happened previously. The fact is that previous weeks it was developed a manipulation and communication campaign financed by the U.S. with the objective of inciting, encouraging people to go out to the streets with the objective of encouraging instability in the country. And they took the opportunity, the advantage of the real hard situation that Cuba is living right now due to the pandemic, due to the reinforcement of the blockade, with the application of more than 240 measures during the Trump administration. And they took that advantage to do their campaign. And during those weeks, they were inciting to violence. They were calling for vandalism acts. They were calling for assaulting the officials of Cuba. They were calling also for sabotage. And as a result, on July 11, vandals went out to the streets, announcing death for communists, breaking glass, throwing stones, making acts of vandalism. Of course, there is also known that a group of dissatisfied people also joined these disorders. Dissatisfied because they have been experiencing a very hard situation in Cuba in the recent month due to several causes. Due to the electro-energetic situation that was having problems during those days. Unfortunately, that problem is already solved in Cuba. But a group of accumulated problems, especially as a result of the blockade. Yeah. And unfortunately, the media have took advantage of that. And they have put a reality of Cuba that it is not. They have over dimension and intentionally exaggerated the size of the protest. And I want also to clarify that in Cuba there was not a social outbreak, as someone has been saying, including the media. In Cuba was disturbances, was disorder, and caused by the manipulation game and manipulation campaign of the U.S. government.
And when you say this manipulation campaign, could you maybe give us some more details? Because I recall there was a few years ago the U.S. tried to create a Cuban version of Twitter, which was with this exact goal of subverting the Cuban government and causing social unrest. Is that something similar that happened now?
Well, yes, it's the same game. They have always applied the same rules, the same procedure against Cuba and other countries. They want to create a reality to show the world, a reality that is not like that. And that's the result. They have, you know better than me, that who have the media have the power. And unfortunately, Cuba is a small island and the U.S. is the most powerful country in the world. And they have all the means to manipulate the media.
Do you feel that the media, not just in the United States, but in the Western world in general, so in Europe, even in Austria, do you think that they've been reporting accurately and honestly on what's happening in Cuba?
No, unfortunately not. They have not respected the principle of impartiality that any journalist must have. Because I think they have limited themselves to replicate what other media said about Cuba without verifying, without contrasting, without even inquiring or I don't know, questioning anything. They have just put the same news that they saw in other media. This is not good. I think, and I don't know if it is a cause of the lack of interest of some media or to the fear of going out the line that have been dictated to them.
I saw in The Guardian, for example, they had a crowd of people protesting, but they were holding the flag of Castro's July 26th movement,
yeah,
and they say
yeah,
it's anti-government.
It's really funny. It's
yeah.
really funny.
And
yeah.
there's even the United Nations, they use a picture of a woman who's in favor of the government. So I wanted to ask about these, like, you know, how big is, how far does this go with this image
yeah.
manipulation?
They have been in an imaginal level. Because they have used false images to say certain things, and after a few days that have been discovered mm-hmm. that is a lie. They have used an image of a parade for the 1st of May of Cuba, of course saying that this was happening in Cuba as the protest.
They say this is the slogan
the protest,
that they have.
Yeah,
right?
they say that July 11, people went out to the streets, and this is the protest, and this is the first of May parade of Cuba. They have also made collage of pictures. This is of pictures of people wounded, even children, and none of them are of Cuba, none of them are Cubans.
You see this typical hashtag, this SOS Cuba, right?
Yeah.
They keep using this
SOS
opposition.
Cuba, SOS Cuba Libre, Cuba Free, it's, well.
What you're seeing happening right now in Cuba with this image manipulation, with the narratives in the media, do you feel that this is something that we've seen maybe before in Venezuela, in Syria, you know, countries that the United States doesn't like, let's put it that way?
Yeah. I think they have applied the same manual for various countries from the Middle East, from Europe, and also from Latin America. Of course, they want to do an interventionist campaign in order to achieve what they call regime change. And the pattern of lies, if used, to justify a military intervention or for encouraging chaos and disturbances and instability in a country that would lead eventually to a regime change. And that's what they have done in other countries.
You know, when it comes to what they're saying, pushing for regime change, we hear some of the loudest voices in favor of regime change. There are Cubans or Cuban exiles living in Miami. Miami is a very big hotspot for this, and these calls for regime change, increasing sanctions, bombing Cuba, do these opinions represent the majority of Cubans living in Cuba?
No. No. This is not the image of the Cubans abroad, and I thank you very much for this question, because this is very important. I have the opportunity to clarify the people who see this interview. Well, there is true that it is true that some radical groups in Miami, especially in Miami, are asking for military interventions and calling for concrete actions against Cuba and saying messages of hate even towards their own relative in Cuba. But this is not the real image that the majority of the people abroad. I think the majority of the people abroad, the Cuban people abroad, love their homeland. love their country. Because I'm not speaking about the ideology. I'm speaking about love to your land, love to your people. And that's what I feel. And this is very important to clarify, because the media have played a very important role here. The media have tried to highlight the manifestation of hate of the Cuban people. But you can also find on internet images, videos, and messages for the other side, for the vast majority of the Cuban people, saying messages of love, strength, and solidarity. And I want to also to recognize, and this is very important, because meanwhile, a part of these radicals were making demonstrations in front of our headquarters, of the Cuban headquarters abroad, diplomatic headquarters, and saying offenses and doing vandalism acts against, yeah, against our embassy.
I saw in Paris yesterday.
Yeah. A vast majority of the other Cubans were struggling to gather medical supplies to send to Cuba. Mm. Yeah, they were doing a lot of efforts trying to send shipments to Cuba with medical supplies, and they achieved that. We have received in Cuba hundreds of shipments of medical supplies thanks to the efforts of these Cubans, of the vast majority of Cubans, with messages of love, strength, solidarity, and unity. And I think that's the image of the Cuban abroad.
When you hear not just Cubans, expatriates or exiles, but politicians, Cuban Americans, like we have Marco Rubio or Ted Cruz, you know, they're calling for action, whatever that means. And you had the Miami mayor, actually, Suarez, who was saying that airstrikes should be on the table. I mean, what is your reaction when you hear things like that, that someone, another person, never mind someone who is claiming to be Cuban, is calling to bomb Cuba? What is your reaction to that?
Well, that is difficult. Because I believe that these people you mentioned, this U.S. politician, doesn't feel like Cubans. That's the answer to your question. Because any Cuban who loves its country cannot promote or call for airstrikes against your own land. And those politicians, I believe that they have a very strict line of political interest, economic interest, and also electoral interest. So they call for maintaining the distance between the U.S. and Cuba. They are also against the rebuilding of ties. I think those people are not Cubans. They don't feel like Cuban.
What's more interesting, considering these politicians in the United States, you know, some of them call themselves socialists or progressives, and yet, you know, when they talk about Cuba, they as we say, I think it's called both-siding the issue. So they say, on one hand, yes, the embargo should be lifted on Cuba. And then they also say that the government is anti-democratic, it's brutalizing the Cuban people. So they repeat the same kind of rhetoric, the same line as, you know, the people we were just talking about now previously. I mean, what are your thoughts on that, like, you know, these politicians?
I believe that those politicians in the U.S. receive a lot of pressure from others. Any politician who wants to express an opinion different from that is the vision of the government receive critics, and it's not well seen in the U.S. And saying something good about Cuba and in the U.S. it has a very high cost for a U.S. politician. That's why I couldn't somehow understand why those politicians have to, for one hand, to criticize the blockade, and the other hand to criticize Cuba to make a balance. But however, I want to recognize and also express my appreciation to those politicians that, in spite of the differences in ideology, have been brave enough as to reject and criticize the policy of sanction against Cuba. That's not an easy action in the U.S., and they have done that.
Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
Considering the ties between the United States and Cuba, Joe Biden, when he was running for president during his campaign, he promised, he said that he would go back to the era of Obama in terms of relations with Cuba. So far, he's failed to do so. Why do you think that is?
Joe Biden has not only maintained the blockade, he has also maintained the reinforcements of the blockade with the 243 measures applied by the Trump administration, and also the 55 measures applied during the time of the pandemic. And he has even applied other sanctions last week, yes, against one official of my country and also an entity of my country. And he said that this is just a beginning. So, speaking about the reason, this is just hypothetical because I have not all the answers. But in my opinion, I believe that this behavior of Biden is a result of the very strong pressures he has been receiving from representatives of these radical groups of anti-Cubans, mm-hmm, that have been asking for concrete actions against Cuba and military intervention. And also he has this behavior is due to the electoral ambitions that Joe Biden has. Towards the Florida state.
As you recalled, he said that this is just the beginning, which, I mean, it sounds like a threat. It's a veiled threat. I mean, do you think that there's any hope the United States will move towards reestablishing ties with Cuba or improving ties in this term, at least?
Well, I hope so. I hope so. We have time. The beginning has not been so good. Actually, has been very bad, even worse than Trump administration, because he maintained the same sanctions that Trump's and even put another one. But we have to give the benefit of the doubt to Biden. Maybe in a few months the policy change. But right now I have not hope. I have no hope because the situation has been very bad.
Speaking of the situation, Cuba is the only country in Central and Latin America who's actually been able to develop its own COVID-19 vaccine. However, as we've seen, because of the embargo, there have been ventilator shortages, syringe shortages. There's all kinds of medical equipment that Cuba's unable to access from abroad. How much has this embargo worsened the situation, even though Cuba has made huge leaps and even sent doctors to other countries to fight this?
I have to start saying that not a single family in Cuba has not been affected by the blockade. Everyone has been affected because the blockade affects every dimension of the Cuban economy and society. And you have mentioned in your question the problems, the difficulties that Cuba has in getting supplies, medical supplies during the pandemic, and this has been as a result of the blockade. And I think that the most painful dimension of the blockade, it's the impact on the health situation, on the health system in Cuba. And another example of the health system, of the impact of these sanctions, is that we in Cuba are deprived from acquiring some medicines only produced in the U.S. For the treatment of cancer, for example. Yes. And this is very painful for the Cuban people, and this is very alarming also.
If we're clear that the embargo and the various other measures that the United States and its allies have taken against Cuba, they do affect the situation economically, socially. I mean, how do you respond to people who try to frame the entire situation, like all these problems, as just the government's fault? You know, they say, oh, this is socialism, and it's the government's fault. And as you mentioned, they say the embargo has nothing to do with this. I mean, what would you respond to these people?
Well, first of all, I have also to recognize that the government of Cuba is not perfect. We have the government has its defects, its deficiencies. Any other government of the world has, and we are trying to resolve those problems. Even the president of the Republic of Cuba.